Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, we welcome back Gina Siepel, woodworker, performance artist, visual artist, sculptor, natural historian, and we're going to be talking about her exhibition that's been traveling. The museum, it's been at the Museum of for Art in Wood, To Understand a Tree, and a new installation in Maine, Forest Geometries. Gina, welcome back to the show. It is a relief to be talking to you right now.
Thank you, Mark. It's so good to be here. I really appreciate it.
We have been trying to set up this interview for months, and something gets in the way. Some interesting things have happened in the way I think about your work, and I think one of them started when I looked at your catalog to the exhibition To Understand a Tree. It was funny. I've really sort of started to get a grip on how the deepness of what you're doing. In that, you know, I thought initially when we talked to you, you're an interesting installation artist and a woodworker. And the way that you sort of seamlessly bring all this together really has given me a deep appreciation of your work. But I want to start by talking a new installation I think you did this year called Forest Geometries. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, thank you for your kind words about the work. I really appreciate that, and I'm glad that you got to see the catalog as well, because
oh my God, it
does a great job of kind of giving a holistic sense of that project. So Forest Geometries, I was invited by the Langley Art Preserve, which is a site that's a really interesting place. It's owned and run by the Georges River Land Trust, which is a land trust in the Georges River watershed in mid-coast Maine, mm-hmm. on the coast. And the place was the home of sculptor Bernard Langley, who was very well known throughout Maine and worked in sound wood. So I was invited by the director of the preserve.
It seems like a perfect fit.
Yeah, exactly. Hannah Blunt is the director and curator of the preserve, and she has begun an initiative to bring in contemporary artists to respond to the land at the site, as well as to other things that are there, which include many of Bernard Langley's sculptures. So I'm very honored to be the inaugural contemporary artist who's been invited to make a piece at Langley. And so I went there in October, and I spent a week in residence just really exploring the forest. They have about 70 acres of forest there. And the legacy of Langley's artistic work. Forest Geometries is the piece that I created there. It's on site, it's outdoors, it's located along the hiking trail, which is a 2.3-mile trail that goes out and sort of meanders in this really beautiful way through this 70-acre kind of transitional deciduous and more boreal forest. I worked with found material. I worked with balsam fir and red spruce deadfall saplings. And I created these geometric structures that really were a response to the dynamics, the ecological process of change that's really strongly visually present in the forest there. There's a lot of kind of transition happening in the ecology, with a lot of young trees coming up, a lot of trees dying out, a lot of decomposition, a lot of wildlife activity. So it's this really visually rich, biodiverse transitional forest. And I created, using deadfall saplings from the land, large-scale versions of these forms that are known as the five platonic solids. So there's five forms. Now I'm going to try to recite them without looking at anything. So it's the tetrahedron, the cube, the octahedron, the dodecahedron, and the icosahedron. Each of these forms is a geometric form defined by identical faces meeting at identical angles. And they were mathematically proven by the ancient Greeks. And then the philosopher Plato actually associated each of these forms with one of the classical elements, which at that time it was thought that the earth was comprised of. So the tetrahedron was associated with fire, the cube with earth, the icosahedron with water, the octahedron with air, and the dodecahedron with ether or the cosmos. I built these forms and located them on the land in sites that had a kind of specific and usually somewhat poetic relationship to the element that was associated with the form. So that's a mouthful. this was a year-long project.
Oh, yeah.
It involved a lot of time really exploring the forest. We walked the land with a forester named Mitch Kinn, who gave us a little bit more information on like the land use history and on the local ecology. I've become like knowledgeable to some degree about forests in western Massachusetts, but it was really interesting to be in mid-coast Maine, where there's quite a lot that's different.
I want to ask you about that, but first I want to talk about the pieces themselves. They're suspended?
Yeah. They're actually not suspended. It might look that way in photographs, but they're elevated on these kind of thin steel posts.
Oh, wow. Because they look like they're floating there.
Yeah, they're really like they're like 5/8 of an inch steel rods with just little brackets on them that we could screw into the pieces in good locations.
They're really magical looking.
Thank you. Yeah.
and the fact that you use found wood, it's like part of the forest, but not.
Exactly. And there we have decided, you know, we had a lot of debate about like, okay, what happens? Like they're just out in the forest, so anything can happen to them. Like a tree could fall on them or a bear could try to climb them.
Cool.
Or something, right? And, you know, the question is like with art, you know, if you were installing a piece in a museum and something happened to it, you would have an arrangement for that, or if you know, outdoor in a sculpture park or something. But in this case, we decided to just sort of like let them be, and
I love that,
just accepting of whatever changes happen to the pieces through the year. And some of that will just be like weathering, and some of it might be, you know, something could happen to one of them. And
is somebody going to go back, or are you going to go back and photo document the changes?
Yeah, so there is a photographer whose name is Ethan Tom. And he is photographing them seasonally.
Oh, wow.
So we have a...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we'll get to share photographs. And the website for the Langley Art Preserve has photographs on it, and those photographs will be updated as we document the project seasonally.
What are some of the things that you anticipate is going to happen?
Yeah, well,
I was wondering about growing, you know, either fungi or lichen.
Yep, for sure. You know, I don't know. Maybe you would know. I don't know how long it takes for lichen to grow, like newly.
Sometimes it depends on the surface, and it depends on the weather condition. There's so many factors, but you can't leave anything like that out in the woods and not experience change.
Totally. So part of the reason we chose to elevate them was we wanted to keep them off the ground because the material itself is like of mixed levels of solidity, really. Like some of it is a little bit like what in woodworking land we would call punky. You know, it's got a little fungal decomposition going on. So some of that wood is really solid. And
so it could really sprout. It's probably already sprouting fungus.
Some of it already, and I didn't remove any bark or anything, a little bit where it just came off, but for the most part, I just left all the lichen and moss that was already on there, though it dried out over the winter. So I expect that there will be growth. There's already like quite a few spider webs. So
I love it.
Taking up residence in the pieces.
So birds are going to come down and start eating the invertebrates that are on the sculpture. Oh,
exactly.
My God. Oh.
The other thing is they're painted. You know, I left this bark on. The bark is like really crusty and textury, and I just love the way it looked. And then I left all the bark and the lichen and moss and everything on, but I painted over it with this really interesting paint. It's called milk paint, and it's a very traditional furniture paint. It's a casein paint. It's actually made from milk, and I used this paint from a company called Real Milk Paint in Tennessee, and the paint is entirely environmentally safe. So the pieces are painted these kind of bright colors to contrast with the visual environment of the forest. They're painted with this paint, and then they're covered with hemp oil to just provide a little conditioning and protection, mostly for the paint and somewhat for the wood. But that bark, as the material like dries out and expands and contracts with temperature change and everything, a lot of that bark is going to fall off, I expect. So that'll make the paint, you know, the look of the paint change quite a bit, because it'll become kind of, there'll be patches that are unpainted where the painted bark has fallen off. I expect that would be one of the more visible changes we'll see. But who knows, you know, like anything could happen.
I'd like to see what fungi is going to grow on it, because it could be spectacular.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, can the public hike on this trail and see these pieces?
Absolutely, yep. So the trail is open all the time. You can just, it's a land trust preserve, so anyone can go, and it's free, or, you know, donations accepted. And there's also this, I created a zine, which we installed with a walking map. So you can actually kind of like follow along on the map, which
Gina
points out a few different natural history kinds of, you know, especially interesting things that I found on the trail, as well as the pieces themselves. And then there's I made a little kind of page for each piece that talks about that site and the relationship between the chosen form and why I put that piece at that site.
Those
are the trailhead.
Wow. You know, you were talking about the difference between the type of forest and the composition of the forest there versus Western Massachusetts. What were the differences?
Yeah, well, I loved being up there after spending so much time in the forest here. It's been amazing to get to know it more there. There's so much water in Mid-Coast Maine. It's amazing. It's like, there's just water everywhere. It's just bubbling up from the ground everywhere you look. And it's coming down from the sky in the form of like fog and rain and mist and snow and everything. And then, of course, it's coastal. So I know you and I are both birders, like it's just amazing because you'd be in the forest and you're seeing all these you know, bird species that you would expect to see, except then all of a sudden there's like a seagull or a cormorant kind of overhead. It's totally confusing.
I love that.
It's really neat. Yeah, because the coast is, you know, there's all these inlets and it's just kind of woven into the forest there. But as far as like the forest composition, it's kind of like a place where the boreal forest to the north kind of intersects with the more mixed deciduous forest that we would have in more like southern or central New England. So I just kind of fell in love with conifers up there.
Yeah.
It's just different. You know, you could be standing in a spot and you're like, oh, there's like four or five species of conifers here. And we don't really tend to have that as much in Massachusetts, maybe in higher elevation places in the Berkshires. But
I think we used to have it. We used to have it 200 years ago.
Sure.
And then I think a lot of that got logged out. And I know that the higher points, you're right, the Berkshires, you can still see little trace areas of what it used to be like. That's a special area up there.
It's really neat. Yeah. So it's like they're just, you know, the presence of balsam fir comes forward very much, and red spruce. And and then, you know, of course, there's white pine and hemlock. And then there's a lot of the deciduous trees that we would normally expect to see. But I think because there's so much water, there's also like just really rich understory vegetation, like more species of ferns than I'm used to seeing, and lots and lots of lichen, lungwort, and all kinds of interesting lichens, and lots of moss everywhere. So it's just kind of like very visually rich and ecologically rich.
Yeah, and it also does strange things to light. Like when you have a forest like that, the lighting in the forest, it gives you a different feel.
That's interesting. Yeah, for sure. And
did you keep a bird list?
I did. Yeah, I was there several times over the year, and I actually need to compile it into one list.
You're so cool.
I kind of kept track separately, but one thing I just wanted to say about the forest is that I think that from what I came to understand, the balsam fir is a tree that often doesn't live a super long time.
Yeah.
And they get kind of like, it's sort of a tree that comes in when there's a lot of light, and then other trees replace it as the light in the forest is reduced. And there's so many trees that are kind of like young seedlings, like just really, really babies, like tiny seedlings, you know, less than 6 feet tall, just tons and tons and tons of them. And then there are so many balsam fir that are dying out or are dead. And so it creates this feeling of like a lot of transition, and that all creates a lot of habitat also for woodpecker species and for insects and You know, there's so it just feels like a place where there's just a lot going on ecologically, which is, I think, the strongest impression that I had as I was kind of getting to know the place.
What's not there that you find in Western Massachusetts?
Great question.
Like, let's talk about species of trees or just their frequency and how dense they are within any population.
Yeah. Well, I'd say I think a lot of our trees here are just larger, like larger diameter.
Huh.
And of course, Western Massachusetts is really diverse too. So
yeah, it's so different from Central and Eastern Massachusetts.
Yeah, like there's a lot of different kinds of forest habitats here. I would say like here, you have this, you know, you don't ever see like tulip tree up there.
Oh God, no.
You know,
although I love tulip trees.
I love them too. Yeah,
that's such a weird tree. People, if you don't know them, go out and find yourself one.
What is that cartoon leaf? One thing that was really interesting, I didn't really look into why this was, but so up there, all of the red oak have this in the bark. They have this reddish tint color that is in the furrows of the bark.
Huh.
Or I think almost all or most of them have this. And I think, I can't remember, I looked it up. It's either a lichen or a fungus. But it's like very commonly on red oak. And here we don't have that.
Would that be the reason it's called red oak?
What's that?
Would that be the reason it was called red oak?
Well, actually, I don't know why. Maybe originally. That's a really good point.
Wow.
But I was like, you know, I'm used to identifying red oak versus white oak by the leaf.
Yeah.
And other people there were kind of pointing it out by the reddish tint on the bark. And so when I mentioned that we don't have that here, people were surprised. It was an interesting example of something that is there but isn't here.
We could talk forever about this, and I think we better move along. Otherwise, we're going to get lost. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, welcoming him back, Gina Siepel. She's a woodworker, performance artist, visual artist, sculptor, natural historian. We've been talking about forest geometries, which is an installation that she just did up in Maine. But now I want to talk about To Understand a Tree, which is, as I understand it, in your latest post. So that's a traveling exhibition, right?
It is now.
Well, originally it was at the Museum for Art and Wood.
That's right. It was at the Museum for Art and Wood from March through July 2024, and it was curated there by Jennifer Nava Milliken. And it has just moved to the Samick Art Museum at Bucknell University.
Nice.
Which is in central Pennsylvania. And it is opening next week, August 27th.
Now, this was based on a long project and a long class project that you conducted at the McLeish Field Station, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you just review that? Because that, first of all, that was an amazing project that you did just on site. That was intense.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a very very deeply invested and long-term project. So I was invited to propose like an artist-in-residence project at the McLeish Field Station of Smith College around 2018. This is the project that you know evolved into the project To Understand a Tree. I worked with a close collaborator, naturalist Kate Wellspring, I worked, you know, closely with ecologists and biologists and other collaborators in the humanities from Smith College. The project involved essentially asking questions about the relationship between humans and trees, and particularly from the viewpoint of a woodworker, someone who works with material that comes from living trees and necessitates the killing of the tree. It was the inspiration was actually in 2017. I listened to a public radio and Radio Lab interview with Suzanne Simard, the forest ecologist who has done all this work on the way trees share resources and nutrients and other things with each other, send chemical signals to each other via mycelial fungal networks.
I learned about that, that just blew my mind.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. So I heard this interview. Of course, as you know, I had been making projects that involve both traditional forms of woodworking and environmental concepts for a long time. And then I heard this interview, and it just was like, it was kind of a life-changing moment, because yeah. I think realizing that trees were in some way connected to each other through these networks made me think differently about their agency mm-hmm. as living beings. And when I started to think about that, I just thought, well, what does this mean for woodworkers? Because previous to that, I had been working with wood in a way that I felt was as ecologically responsible as I could within living in modern society. So, you know, I was trying to work with sustainably sourced materials, and I was trying to not be wasteful. I don't work with tropical woods and things like that. But then when I started to really confront, like, this idea of, like, interconnection between living trees, and I thought, wow, so when you cut down a tree, you're actually impacting an ecological community, not just a single organism. And somehow that really changed my thinking. And my idea was to try to make a project that really delved into that as a question. And it sort of led into, like, in a sort of really fundamental way, realizing that I needed to understand the forest and understand trees a lot better. And I proposed a piece, which is what became To Understand a Tree, in which I would spend a good deal of time with a particular tree in the forest and try to come to some better understanding of it, both ecologically in terms of its, like, you know, more the natural history side of things, and also relationally, like, what does it mean for a person to try to relate to a being that is so different from themselves and that you can't have, like, a verbal communication with, like we're having right now.
Right, yeah.
So that was the impetus for the project.
I found that project totally inspirational. And when you were talking about the way of working with wood, is that what you call green woodworking?
Yeah, so I got interested in green woodworking through this, which is a way of working with wood that kind of allows you to sort of skip over all the industrial processing
yep,
of the material.
Yep.
So it's especially well suited to chair making. And there's a long tradition of what's called greenwood chair making or green woodworking in the U.S. and in England. And essentially what it is you work with a log that's been, you know, cut either very, very recently or relatively recently, and you split the log with, like, wedges and axes and other traditional tools as opposed to sawing the log. And what this does is it means that you're really, really dealing with the fibers of the wood in a very close way.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're really dealing with, like, you know, these, I really have come to think of it as, like, these are the biological properties of this material. These are the same material properties that allow the tree to live are the ones that you're dealing with structurally in the making of a chair. And so this process seemed really well suited to this project.
It's fascinating because you really start to, through your work, you really start to understand the complexity of just a single tree. Then the idea of a forest blows your mind. I mean, it becomes too much to deal with practically. And that's why the idea of dealing with a single tree makes so much sense.
Right, right. Yeah, that's really interesting that you...
Because when you start to try to think of all of that, I think you just end up, you know, going into a lotus position, and then that's it for the rest of your life. I mean, because it's just like every once in a while when I'm in a forest, I start looking at everything, and it's just like, yeah, you easily lose yourself in the complexity of the forest.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think especially toward the beginning of the process, I felt totally overwhelmed by that.
You did these projects as part of this that made so much more sense. You did things where people meditated. You did mm-hmm. technical things where people were measuring trees.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
all of it, put it all together, you really started to get a handle on one tree and the complexity of it.
Yeah, I think that in a way it's like, you know, in all my work, I'm really interested in learning. And I use a lot of these projects as kind of ways to slow down and focus on some kind of learning. And then also share that learning out with audiences. So, you know, it's sort of like positioning the artist as what the art theorist Claire Pentecost talks about as a public amateur. It's a kind of like a public intellectual, but yeah, who's learning instead of telling. So I think the model of learning that I think we evolved into in this project was really to say, like, okay, here's this really complex space and these really complex questions that intersect with this space. So we kind of like move around in order to try to get some kind of holistic grip on the situation, and also something that can be shared out with participants and audiences and collaborators. It's like, let's create a constellation of instances in a way.
Okay.
So the work with Bob Leverett, who's a mathematician and engineer and an old growth forest specialist, an ecologist, he has a very particular way of measuring the carbon content of a tree. And so he can produce fairly accurate numbers. And so we learned that the unfortunately, I can't remember off the top of my head what the actual number was on the amount of pounds of carbon, but it was equivalent to like a year of driving a car, right?
Oh, my God. Hey, Gina, we're going to, unfortunately, completely out of time.
Oh, okay.
I didn't plan on that. Today, we welcome back Gina Siepel, woodworker, performance artist, visual artist, sculptor, natural historian, and so much more. And we've been talking about, to understand a tree, an exhibition based on what we were just talking about her project in the McLeish Station. And then we've also been talking about forest geometries, which sounds like it's worth a trip to go see. I've seen the photographs of it, and it's pretty outstanding. And we're obviously going to have you back to talk about. I want to hear about the changes that go on with forest geometries. Gina, it's been a pleasure as always.
It's always great to talk with you, Mark. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.